I'm Sanjit Sethi, president of the Minneapolis College of Art and Design, and this is On Topic, where I engage with creative cultural leaders on pressing issues facing artists, designers, and the wider creative community. In this season of On Topic, we're exploring creativity and equity and how it relates to work, leadership, teaching, and beyond. I couldn't think of a better way to start this season's podcast than with my two guests, who also happen to be MCAD alumni, print-based studio artist Jonathan Herrera Soto and technical artist and animator Mike Medicine Horse. Our wide-ranging conversation, recorded this past August, touched on issues such as the role of mentorship, collaboration, racial inheritance, and social responsibility. It was a pleasure to speak with Jonathan and Mike and get their insights, which are so relevant to the reality we occupy now. I want to welcome my two guests today, Jonathan Herrera Soto and Mike Medicine Horse, both fantastic creative cultural leaders, and I'm so excited to be part of this podcast series. So welcome, the two of you.
Thanks for having me.
First and foremost, I'll introduce my two guests a little bit and know that we'll get to know them more through this conversation as we start to talk both about their really rich backgrounds and narratives, but also about their thoughts about issues regarding creative and cultural leadership, as well as equity, and what they've been learning from the past 18 and 20 months. So first, Mike Medicine Horse is a graduate of the Minneapolis College of Art and Design from the class of 2000. He's a computer animator. He's a Crow Indian from Montana who moved to the Twin Cities to attend MCAD. Mike is currently a lead 3D technical artist at Target. He's also worked as a medical animator and a media artist for e-learning applications. So thanks again, Mike, for joining us. We're really fortunate to also have Jonathan Herrera Soto, who's from the Minneapolis College of Art and Design class of 17. Jonathan's a print-based studio artist and really sees printmaking as an act of love through translation. I was fortunate enough to first meet Jonathan when I first arrived at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design through an exhibition he had at the Minneapolis Institute of Art, which involved prints that were on the floor that viewers were supposed to walk over that dealt with the trauma of migration. Really fortunate to have him, especially as he's starting his working towards his MFA in painting and printmaking at the Yale University School of Art. So welcome to you too, Jonathan. Yeah, I'm going to start by talking that both of you have just had some interesting moments here in the past month, and I think there may just be something to reflect on this. Mike, as you and I were talking before the podcast actually started, that there's an annual powwow that occurs over in Crow Junction called Crow Fair, and because of the pandemic last year, you weren't able to attend, but you did this year. Do you want to explain to us what Crow Fair is and why it's so important for you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So Crow Fair is happens annually in the third weekend of August, and there's a few things that happen. There's a powwow that happens every day. There's also parades. Rodeos happen out there as well. And one of the main things that happens there is everyone comes together to camp there at the festival. So it's mainly the main area of it is 3 days. But people will come and camp there a few days before just to kind of get settled in. They'll bring so many things in, so much furniture, just to live in that space for 4 to 5 days. But it's really a moment to connect with family who maybe you haven't connected with in a while, and just to be together and living and cooking together for those days. So it's really a good connection point to get in touch with everybody. Even though it's a small reservation, I feel like it's hard to be in touch with everyone. And it's just a good time to do that since we're all so close together.
What's one thing that if you're not from the Crow Nation, that's hard to understand about going to Crow Fair?
I think it's just the, and maybe for people who camp often, this is easier to understand, but, you know, it's really about setting up camp and being at camp and being in that experience, which is, you know, you have a role when you go there. Are you going to be the cook? Are you going to be the person who cleans? You know, and it's just being around and sitting around. You know, it's not really like dictated by activity. It's more about being in the space and spending time with the other.
For me, I had heard about Crow Fair in part because of the collection of teepees, you know, and I think it's the largest collection of teepees that are assembled in North America at any one given time. And I, you know, I just think I keep thinking about that in relationship to, you know, to craft and to, you know, artistry. And I'm just wondering, is there a way that you can, is there an aspect of that, that the type of artistry or craftsmanship that you can illuminate us on a little bit about kind of how that may have been part of kind of a part of your upbringing?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. There really is a craft to the way that, you know, the Crow people do teepees versus, you know, someone of a different tribe. And there are, you know, craftsmen, you know, who you seek out to either set up a teepee or, you know, find poles. And it's, you know, it's someone that's actively sought out. But is it a great skill? I would love to know that skill, right? And so, you know, and I do think there is that element of creativity to it and how you assemble your teepee. So that would be a goal if I could learn that. You know what I mean? There's just a handful who do. And even so, there's also the other side, which is going out and getting teepee poles. You know, that's also a skill, which is going through there and getting them and just getting them prepared for that too. So there's kind of like twofold. There's like the teepee poles and then there's actually assembly.
Jonathan, you've just started a new adventure of being at the Yale School of Art. And I guess first and foremost, how's that transition going?
I graduated from MCAD in 2017, and I've had a few years to try to like figure out what I'm doing and, you know, what's to come. And for the most part, had a pretty steady line of work right after graduating. I taught, thanks to my friend Lindsay, she recommended me for this job at Juxtaposition Arts, where I taught for a year from 2017 to 2018 in their textile department. I was one of their co-leads, and it really was a nurturing opportunity to connect with youth and to provide like a type of mentorship and teach in a way that has nurtured me throughout my, you know, my student years. And it felt really good to teach. And at MCAD, actually, I did their teaching artist minor. So even in school, I had the opportunity to teach. And, you know, thanks to Linda, who ran the teaching artist program, had a lot of experience as a student leaving. So I felt really comfortable in my job at Juxta. And, but after a year, I think there's a shift in wanting to, see if I can make this art everything is art, to make a shift to see if I can sustain a practice as a priority, as like making being the predominant thing. And so all of 2018, most of early 2019, I was on the road, kind of really cranking out work and thinking I knew what I was doing was like my most authentic, most honest self. And then the pandemic came, and in like March of 2020, I traveled to the East Coast to shelter in place with my partner, who was pursuing a graduate degree at Brown University, and realized that a lot of my practice was codependent on like the institutional framework, on like these like colonial structures of reward and glittering like legitimacy, or like not authentic legitimacy. I realized that I was like codependent on something that was leaving me spiritually malnourished. And I spent a lot of this pandemic kind of reflecting and unpacking my practice and learning how to make for myself, for my ancestors and for my ghosts from like the ground up. I like had to construct a new way of making that felt nourishing to me. I feel ready for mentorship, for a bit of guidance. And also like, you know, as a student, being a student at MCAD who has participated in a lot of student activities on campus, I'm excited to attend such a what would the word be, famous program or something see what's composting, because this time, these last couple of years has changed everything. And I think artists have a lot more power than they used to have. Like traditions are being questioned in a way that, you know, has to be acknowledged. And it's interesting creative terrain, and I'm excited to, you know, be thrown in the midst of it and see how I contribute or how I can texture all the changes that are, you know, kind of happening in the midst, but also like art to come.
One thing that you're touching on, Jonathan, is something that I love to talk to both of you about, which is this idea of mentorship. I have to say I get allergic to the term mentorship sometimes, because I think it's a sometimes overly used term. But that being said, I guess I want to start with the two of you by just, you know, seeing from your perspectives, is how do you both define mentorship?
Yeah, for me, it would be someone who has an investment in your goals, you know, challenges that you'd be facing, and helping you to break those down, you know, and find a way. I think you're right. There could be this delineation between teaching and mentorship, where I think mentorship is a little more sharing experience versus maybe directly teaching. At least that's how I see it anyway. I like to share in my mentorship roles just how I've faced challenges, how I've dealt with, you know, even people, you know, which is important, because I think that's a critical component, is how to help, you know, younger people in situations they may not have been before, or to watch out for, you know, anything that, or any problems that might come along the way based with on what I've done. So that's how I see mentorship.
I've got some thoughts here too, but Jonathan, if you're defining mentorship, how are you defining it?
Yeah, Mike, I think I resonate with what you said, that I think there could be a distinction between a teaching role and a mentorship role. And I think mentorship to me doesn't look particularly legible. It's almost like learning from experience or praxis or something. Two of my most supportive mentors of mine at MCAD were like Natasha Pestich and Piotr Szaholski, who are actually both come from this immigrant narrative. Like they both kind of have a lot of inheritance culturally from like elsewhere. And I think I resonated with that kind of subconsciously. I didn't really articulate that until recently. Like, whoa, we have some stuff in common that we've never perhaps like super talked about it, but it's like felt in the way that they approach the world and their art practice. And with both of them, I spent a lot of time with them outside of campus. I mean, outside of like the teaching classroom. Like with Piotr, I remember helping him with his labor camp projects, and back in the day when Soap Factory was around, and installing his solo show there and seeing how he works, or like talking to Natasha in regards to like student activism and needing some sort of guidance, and Tasha also being really involved with like organizing, and just seeing how someone works in their field and kind of the stuff you can't really describe. Like it reminds me of like the summer job I had remodeling houses, and how you're doing something in some like weird way that you're not supposed to be doing, and then you watch someone who has done it for like 20 years like spray the joint compound mixture with like water and putting plastic over it, so you don't have to like wash your tools every time you're done using it. Like, I don't know, more efficient ways of working. And you're just like watching someone in the craft that they've developed over years that, you know, as a younger person or as someone who is learning from them doesn't have that experience. So you're just kind of in the midst of watching someone and learning from them in their work.
I wonder if maybe it's too big an umbrella in the sense, like, you know, I think that I wonder if, because, you know, Jonathan, what you're talking about, right? That kind of, that following, that kind of almost like a pseudo apprenticeship, but not quite, right? And since, you know, that kind of watching that physical activity of how you do something, it's the, you know, the junior baker that comes in, the baker in training that comes in and understands, okay, you know, I've got a, you know, this is how you knead, this is the kind of proportions, this is what you're looking for, you know, and I, you know, I feel like that's kind of a whole, you know, situational kind of learning by doing, learning by following, you know, maybe even different than what we see more formally known as pedagogy in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And then I wonder if there's this more kind of notion of giving support, right? Being the, being the individual that provides counsel and feedback, ideally. I also say that, you know, and I'm thinking the fact that, you know, we're all, you know, three people of color as we're talking. And I'm thinking too, that are there, how much of this idea of mentorship is a Western construct, you know, and I'm reflecting on this in part because, Mike, you know, you were talking about kind of when you were talking about Crow Fair and saying that how, you know, like there's a totally different valuation of purpose, right, in terms of why you're there and why you gather, you know, since and why you sit together instead of feeling like you're always doing something, you're always trying to achieve a goal. And I wonder if the soul of mentorship is really about just being able to hold space and not feeling like it's purpose driven.
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept. And I think at least that also, I feel that too with how things are taught, at least back home. I do feel it's much more in that apprenticeship realm, you know, like here's the skill. Not a whole lot of that, like, feedback, which I think is really critical. Like, here is, you know, something you could be doing better. There's that really the concept of analysis, which I really haven't kind of come to until I've come to, you know, these more traditional spaces, which I think we do need that. You know, we do need a place to be able to validate and say, you know, here's what you're doing, but here's what you could be doing better. And not in a negative way, but, you know, feedback as a way to kind of focus in on your blind spots.
I think that they're right in that distinction between mentorship and teaching. I'm remembering reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed and kind of like there being an outline of like teacher-student, student-teacher relationships and it being rooted in reciprocity, that it's not like this, like, I think Paulo Freire uses the term like banking system of teaching, where you like are inserting knowledge, like if it's a coin, into like a piggy bank, an empty piggy bank. But there's this outline of like a reciprocal relationship where the teacher is both teacher student and the student is both student teacher. And I think fundamentally, that whole book is attempting to envision or to put language to a decolonized method of pedagogy, of like complicating and texturing the instilled, hierarchical, like ladder, like form within, like harbored within, like education and institution. Maybe it speaks also back to that reward system of like, someone does the rewarding and the one receives versus there being rewards and gifts from both ends.
I'd love to talk to both of you kind of as we're moving, thinking about this and thinking about it in relationship to both of your practices. I guess I'd love to know if there's a personal story that both of you could share with me regarding a connection you had with someone that created a light bulb moment for you, you know, where you felt like, wow, things fell into place, you know, in a way that you found to be astounding.
You know, I think something that provided me like a lot of clarity and I think speaks to this theme of like colonial lenses is having this Zoom call with my mom. I talk with my mom a lot. recently, and like in the middle of the pandemic, and I was asking her all these questions, like, what does it feel like as an undocumented, you know, like I kind of like get very much in my American, like, kind of voyeurism sometimes with my family. And I like ask these questions of like, what's the undocumented experience of like the pandemic? We're all experiencing this like immense like isolation due to the COVID pandemic, like social distancing. You can't be close, you know, like to people. You like have to be wary and like distrustful of like people in public settings, and you have to like be at home all the time. And like, that's the experience of my family for the past 20 years, you know, like you can't, you know, they purposefully, or at least for my parents, you purposely don't have, you know, like many friends, and you don't spend that time, a lot of time outside, because more time spent outside is more risk, right? To be caught or to be exposed. Like the mental deterioration that we feel, are feeling this like panic of like, I don't like this, being inside all the time is driving me crazy or something like that. I think we have a lot to learn from like the undocumented or immigrant communities, because these people have been isolated and in their houses and for decades, forever. And it's like, what, we're all wondering what like a year of isolation is going to do to us. Like, all we have to do is go to our like immigrant neighbors and ask them like, how has it felt to be so isolated or fearful for this long? And, you know, like it complicates our relationship to like everything, like this colonial lens that, like the apocalypse is happening right now, but for like many, many, many people, in the apocalypse has already happened. You know, they've gone through multiple, they're in the midst, they've, you know, like, I think it builds bridges to our neighbors to be able to like learn. And maybe it goes back to this teaching like topic that you're talking about, like what can we learn from people who have gone or are going through some of the most unique and unimaginable experiences that we find ourselves in, you know?
Yeah, I think building on that, and sort of like on the other side of that isolation topic, you know, a lot of what I've done and my goals have been very kind of focused in on, you know, predominantly like these white spaces being like 3D, very tech, very, you know, not a whole lot of, you know, people of color in those fields. And so going through that, you know, there was this isolation, which I didn't know I felt until I had reached Target. And then I had more people of color who were working in this space, who were also leaders, who were also doing similar or parallel fields. And I think that was the biggest revelation to me, is just acknowledging that I was in isolation, right? Like I was not of... I was just lacking that. And I think that has really been the biggest thing for me in my transition, and just, you know, getting to connect with so many great, you know, people who code, who are also people of color. That's just amazing to be part of that in a way that I wasn't before. And so I think that was a huge revelation to me for switching.
Mm. Yeah. You know, and it occurs to me that you're both involved in such fields that have such a very specific and distinct vocabulary. When I think of print in printmaking, for instance, I mean, there are processes and vocabularies that are so specific to that. And the same thing with animation. And I guess I'm wondering about what are the ways that you start to feel like you're pushing the definitions that may exist, or the preconceived notions that exist within these two medium? Are there things that you're doing that you think are really going ahead and kind of, you know, pulling at the edges of this? And if so, how? Or things that you think that within this area that you think are on the cusp of changing?
Yeah. The biggest thing for me is just to be in this space and to do this work. I think that I would love to be an example for other Native Americans to be, hey, I could also do 3D animation and 3D rendering. I could also work at Target, you know? And just to be an example for everyone on, you know, we can do this technical work, you know, very technical, very in this space that is very unexpected, you know? And so that's what I'm hoping to unlock here ultimately and to share back.
I still am and label myself as a printmaker, but if you go on my website or look at my work, it's kind of like really hard to like see it because it involves sculpture, it involves drawing and painting and performance, and it's all these different things. But you know, holding and harboring this like idea of print is really important to me, and diversifying the visual language or the visual parameters we use to like see printmaking. But for like collectors who want, you know, like to have an artifact or to have a piece of like the artist but can't afford at a certain level, they buy prints. And they buy prints at like a tenth of the cost because they're duplicates, like they're editions of 20 or 25 or whatever. And there's this inherent like hierarchical system of how we value art and paintings and sculpture. And there's this like inherent like quality in printmaking that inherently has the potential to be a duplicate. Therefore, it's a threat. Therefore, it's a threat to capital. Therefore, it's a threat to like, kind of like this colonial notion of having the only one, like I only have the only one, but I still have the matrix. I could make another one if I wanted to. And there's this like kind of negotiation that needs to happen. It's like kind of how to participate in this like market, acknowledging it. I feel like power is really masked in the art world, and it's hard to talk about the money of things or the politics of things or the things that happen with the networks of power. And printmaking, I don't know. I feel like my place is in printmaking to kind of complicate that in the ways that I can. I need to find ways of resistance because I'm also simultaneously participating in the machine. And printmaking ancestrally roots me to my like ancestors in that it has a really rich, you know, radical and like grassroots history in Latin America.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, you know, Jonathan, I think, you know, for my ambition, you know, at where I'm at, I've been building essentially towards a name, right? Like I feel like for those, you know, the gatekeeping situations, those places where it would be hard to have opportunity. What I'm really working towards is just being able to have these partners, these people that I've worked with, to be able to kind of sustain myself and say, hey, Mike Medicine Horse is going to, you know, set up his own studio and, you know, sell his art directly, and to be able to bring people along, right? So that it could be sustainable and so that I'm not kind of feeding into this broader machine. Because I do have this desire to make more personal directed art, you know, and explore really what native art means and maybe even deconstruct that, you know. And I don't foresee myself trying to shop that to a gallery, right? Like, or trying to like make it fit, right? Like, or to say like my art, since I'm Native American, has to go to Santa Fe or some like, you know, predetermined channel. I want to make that channel, you know? And I think making my own network and making my own connections and making my own name is really where I see that happening. And that's, you know, that's my long goal.
In some ways, I think that that's a great segue, you know, for me into asking these two questions that I think start to really coalesce maybe a lot of this conversation. And so I'll ask the first one to both of you, which is that, you know, what do you know now that you didn't know 5 years ago?
And I think for me, and this is mainly situational, I would say, I've been in this industry for over 20 years now. So if, you know, 5 years ago you asked me the same question, I probably wouldn't have the same answer due to where I was at. But thankfully, I had the opportunity to switch to Target, and that changed a lot for me. And I think the biggest thing is perspective. Not only the type of investment someone else can have in me, you know, that was a new one. But also just acknowledging, you know, personal development, right? And how can I not only build my artistic skills, but just build, you know, my personal skills and things that I maybe have not been able to focus on. So I think that is the biggest thing. Like I think 5 years ago, I was very much in the very technical, how do I do this in 3D or how do I make this thing 3D? And, you know, now it's more like, how can I maybe make this work for myself as a studio, or how can I make this work through other people? How can I kind of work on defining a lot of what I was doing, which is mentorship, which is leadership, which is advocacy, you know, just larger concepts that I've been able to define by switching to Target. So I think it's been amazing to be able to be separated from the work and just to learn more about where I fit in the broader sense by working. So I'm pretty happy with where I was at now versus 5 years ago.
Jonathan, what do you know now that you didn't know 5 years ago?
I think 5 years ago, I was very much a workaholic. I had this notion of like, this, you know, like hard work, like is the cure or something. I think looking at it in a more abstract sense, like I was working really hard, like someone who would be like working like 40, I don't know, like a job. And it was like, there was no room for levity. And it wasn't until like the pandemic that I really got to see this like other side of like resistance, which is like, how do you stop, or how do you like resist a machine that feeds itself on work? It's to rest, or it's to like not say yes to every opportunity. It's to like purposefully slow down, or to like celebrate or have joy and levity in life. I want to like, I think, complicate this notion of working hard towards like progress and, you know, like prioritizing these more abstract notions of work or of like success or of like, maybe the word would be like sustainability. Like what does sustainability really mean, or how can we accomplish that collectively? I think I was replicating the models that were like, are used against us, you know, like I was just inheriting them and rebranding them and wishing I had the hindsight to complicate my worldview a little bit.
Yeah, I think even in the past 18, 19 months, right, the notion of kind of how we approach work has really dramatically changed. And I know, Jonathan, you were talking about that. And so it's great to hear you both kind of reflect on that. Well, the second question I want to ask you, in some ways this kind of helps wrap up our time together, is one that I think is connected to the earlier one, which is, what do you know and believe to be true that you think no one else in your field believes in?
It's hard because I think I like everything I think about. It's like I know some folks that probably think this is true, but I talk a lot about my practice as like sacred space. Like it took me a while to put language to it, but I think as someone who's generationally been, you know, like displaced and removed from like a certain regional or indigenous knowledge, I remember this indigenous art collective, Post-Commodity, using this term lost tribe, but I feel lost a lot of the time. And in between two colonial languages, in between two colonial cultures, with no specific allegiance to any, you know, like any flag. And the studio space is kind of this place where things fall into place and I get to talk to people who are gone or who I've never met or I haven't met yet. And it's like time or like space and like time kind of collapse. And I'm also talking to my past self and future self, because like stuff I did 5 years ago or 2 years ago is currently informing me as I make. Therefore, I have to believe that I'm informing myself down the road, and it's a place where kind of time goes back and forth in that way. So it's like this weird, wiggly space that a bunch of stuff happens that feels really powerful. And I kind of really tap into it as like a sacred, like learning space, the studio?
I think one of the things, I think that to have this racial theme to the question, mm-hmm. I do believe that there is an inherent, structural racism to this industry that, if I was to tell another colleague, would they believe me? They'd basically no. And what I mean by that is just by the nature of how I got here, it was a very focused effort that I knew that could I stay in Montana and do 3D animation? I knew there's no way I could be, on my res and do this. I needed to be in a bigger city. I needed to have access to the software, to the hardware, to be able to do that. And so I think that, kind of decoupling from, my family, which in of itself is something that is kind of frowned upon, but I had their support and this vision, to do it. And so I think that thing, although I want to be an advocate to be in this space, I do know that there is going to be challenges to pursue it, right? It's like you're going to need, faster internet. You're going to need access to hardware. You need access to software. The starting price to even be in this industry is thousands and thousands of dollars. You know what I mean? And that's going to be difficult, in a place where, maybe fixing a car is a challenge, right? Like being able to kind of get into this is going to be difficult. And so I think that is something I just want to acknowledge, and is that that's a barrier and that's a challenge. And, it's going to fall by the wayside when just basic things need to come up first.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really powerful addition to what you said earlier too. And in many ways, I do think this goes back to this idea of the type of leadership. And I think that leadership is really exemplified in both of you, because it's not just a regular form of leadership. It's that creative cultural leadership that I think, for me, defines the two views we've gotten together today in hearing diverse practices, diverse methodologies and histories. But at the same time, I think just also kind of understanding what's the stuff that it takes to go ahead and really go ahead and not just give back, but to go ahead and provide pathways for others too. So thank you both. I've been fortunate to be joined today by Jonathan Herr-Soto and Mike Medicine-Horse, two fantastic artists and designers. And again, thanks again for joining us today and having the time for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of On Topic. To find out more about all of my guests this season and from season one, head to mcad.edu/ontopic, where you can find profiles and links to all of our guests. Make sure to tune in to next month for my interview with Sarah Bellamy of Penumbra Theater. If you haven't already, don't forget to like, rate, subscribe, and follow wherever you're listening. And you can always find out more content at mcad.edu/ontopic.